WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Noah Bookstein with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, April 28th. Beloved local Sarasota restaurateur Samuel Ray unexpectedly passed away at the end of last week. Ray was the co-owner of Tsunami Lakewood Ranch and Hanami Sushi Cocktails and Grill. Hanami just opened Friday, April 10th in the Rosemary District following a year of renovations documented by Ray on social media. In an announcement on Facebook, Hanami wrote, "Sam was a passionate restaurateur, creative force, and beloved member of the Sarasota community." No specific cause of death was given, but the company's Facebook post mentioned his passing followed a recent accident. Co-owners Jeffrey Karasawa and Jason Clamson will continue to operate the restaurant Ray helped build. The Democratic Women's Club is organizing local parents, students, educators, and community leaders for a rally outside Fiona McFarland's district office today at 4 p.m. They are demanding accountability over deep funding cuts to Sarasota's public schools. Community members are concerned that tens of millions of dollars have been redirected from public schools through universal voucher programs. Universal voucher programs provide up to $8,000 of state-funded subsidies per student that is removed from public schools and given to families who send their children to private schools. The program has been mired with issues including delayed payments, unequal distribution of funds, and the inability to track payments to an estimated 30,000 students. Organizers say more than 130 instructional positions in Sarasota have already been eliminated, with up to 180 total on the chopping block. Organizers are calling for restoring income caps on voucher programs, repealing charter co-location provisions, and greater budget transparency around privatization funding. On Monday, Governor Ron DeSantis proposed a new congressional map that would profoundly change the congressional districts of several Democratic Party incumbents. The Republican-controlled legislature is expected to approve the new lines during a special session on redistricting that begins today. If approved, the changes would take effect before the 2026 midterm elections and imperil the seats held by Democratic Representatives Kathy Castor of the Tampa area, Lois Frankel of South Florida, Darren Soto of Central Florida, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz of South Florida. District 16, which currently covers all of Manatee County, would expand considerably to cover parts of Pinellas County, Sarasota County, and all of DeSoto County. Florida is pressing on with the unusual mid-decade redistricting effort at the request of President Donald Trump. Several other states, including Texas and Democratic-run California and Virginia, are also attempting redistricting. This has been Noah Bookstein with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, April 28th.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 85 of our Changing Environment. The previous show was Melody Matrix, usually hosted by Neil.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and this show is being recorded Friday, April 10th, and through some WSLR wizardry is being broadcast on April 28th, 2026.
Today we're going to be talking with Lee Amos, Director of Land Management and Environmental Programs at the Elling Ide Center.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Lee, it's great to have you on the show. Before we get into your role, tell us about the Ide Center, an important local facility that is probably more obscure than it should be.
Absolutely. The Elling Ide Center is based in Sarasota, Florida. We're a special collections research library, scholarly retreat, and 72-acre nature preserve on Little Sarasota Bay. Of course, Elling, who lived here his whole life and started this center, he called it Indianola. So he had his own place name, and on all of his letters, he's writing Indianola, not BAMO or Sarasota. So I suppose it's who you ask, but our mailing address is Sarasota. We're located there, you know, across from the old Sarasota Square Mall, right at near BAMO Road, intersection of BAMO, Beneva, and US 41, northwest corner of that intersection.
And so you said it was 72 acres?
Yes, sir.
And some of that was protected recently through a conservation easement, is that right?
That's right, yeah, just last year in 2025. And actually, I met Elling in 2010. I was working, you know, at Conservation Foundation of the Gulf Coast as acquisition agent for the Environmentally Sensitive Lands Protection Program of Sarasota County. We met with Elling to talk about acquiring his property, you know, in some fashion, protecting it. And we weren't able to work with Elling on that project, but we kept working year over year over year with the foundation, you know, after Elling passed, trying to protect this land. It's such a critical property, an incredible piece of old Florida on the bay. And we were very happy in 2025 to finally, you know, working with the county, put a conservation easement on at least 15 acres of the 72 acres. And this is a buffer of natural habitat on the south side of Sarasota County's Bayonne Preserve, which I think is a 14-acre scrub preserve. Yep, so 15 acres of it is conserved, kind of legally speaking.
And so now when people drive south on 41, there's a lot of development taking place along 41 north of there, right?
There sure is, and that is such a heartbreak to me. That property, you know, I remember talking with the owners in 2010, same time we're talking with Elling, trying to preserve all of this. That land was historically owned by Elling and Elling's family, and he sold it in 2005. And yeah, it's now being developed. It's an incredible loss of habitat.
Yeah, well, we're seeing that a lot. Luckily, we'll have a referendum and people can decide what they want to do about that. So Elling ran into some issues with the county. He had some property he wanted to develop in that area, and they were working on a settlement. And I don't remember all the terms of the settlement. I do remember two things. One is there was a requirement that there be a bronze statue of a gopher tortoise. And the other was that New College hire a professor to teach the Miccosukee language. But unfortunately, the settlement didn't happen, so we never ended up with a faculty member teaching Miccosukee at New College.
This is so fascinating. You know, this is going to be such a meandering conversation, I'm sure. You know, what's so fun about the Elling Ide Center is Mr. Ide, you know, his mind, his legacy was so diverse. And there's all these threads and, you know, so many people knew him and you hear all these stories. And I'm just constantly, I've been here 6 months, constantly pulling the view back on this mosaic and understanding what the picture is. Elling was a huge gopher tortoise lover. His gopher tortoise Winchester is probably the oldest tortoise on record. It's still alive, outlived him. It went to Harvard with him, lived in the dorm.
Wow.
her name is Winchester. And he was a huge gopher tortoise lover. And we have gopher tortoise here at the Ide Center. We're managing habitat for them. So I'm not surprised to hear about a bronze statue. Uh-huh. I hadn't heard that particular detail. And then Elling did endow a professorship at the University of Florida in indigenous Florida languages.
There
so
you go.
That has happened. There is an Elling Ide professor of, and I'm probably getting the title wrong, but Elling Ide professor of, you know, indigenous languages at the University of Florida.
So talk about some of the things that are happening at the Ide Center that you're not directly involved in, and then we'll get around to your role.
You know, our mission is to advance scholarly research in the humanities and environmental sciences, focusing on medieval China and Inner Asia. I do not focus on medieval China and Inner Asia, and I probably know next to nothing about those two things. So a lot of our work is in our research library, focusing on Asia, and we really do have three pillars to our mission. It's library, preserve, and research. And so library and preserve are maybe two locations, and research is this overarching umbrella of what's happening in both areas. Yeah, so this library is the largest private, one of the largest private non-circulating research libraries for Asia in the United States. And we bring scholars from around the world and around the nation here to do original research, to have workshops, and we're actively growing our collection and developing new residencies and fellowships and research programs in our library.
So, Lee, tell us more about what your responsibilities are at the IDE Center.
Well, I was hired just 6 months ago. I'm their first director of land management and environmental programs. So to date, Elling passed away in 2012, and to date, the foundation has focused primarily on building that library. They've now turned their attention to the preserve, and I've created a land management plan for the preserve and am starting the program of restoring and enhancing this habitat. Also part of this is our 10-acre arboretum of fruit trees and exotic trees from around the tropics that Elling created. And I'll be understanding this arboretum and developing an arboretum program of some sort over the coming years.
So Elling, what's interesting is that the site where you're working at the IDE Center is both a mix of important native habitat, but also the remnants of this important collection of tropical and subtropical fruit trees. Mm-hmm. Elling and I were founding members of the Sarasota Fruit and Nut Society, which eventually had to change its name because someone failed to file some paperwork with Tallahassee. But Elling, he was a leader in the community in terms of interest in subtropical plants. He had a breadfruit tree. I don't know where he got it, but he had a breadfruit tree, and he'd constructed a sort of temporary greenhouse that he would build around it each fall with, like, translucent panels to try and protect it from frost, because I guess breadfruit's a little more tropical and a little less subtropical. He was well positioned there on the bay, probably one of the warmer sites in the county for growing subtropical fruit trees. So what do you know about the extent of his original plantings and what remains of that subtropical arboretum?
Well, a lot of what I know is based on our inventory of the arboretum done by Marie Selby Botanical Gardens in 2017. And so since that date, we've had just a couple of hurricanes. And as I understand it, really Milton is the one that wreaked havoc on the arboretum.
Was that from salt water or wind or both, or what was the problem?
From wind, yeah. And I've done a soil test throughout the property. We don't have a problem with salinity in our soils. There was inundation, but not throughout the site. But yeah, wind damage, lots of wind damage. The 2017 inventory shows over 1,000 trees in the arboretum area. About half of those are native cabbage palm / pine and live oak, and half, about 455 species of exotic trees. And those cover, I think, 69 plant families.
Mm.
There's a lot of representation from the Ericaceae, the palm family. And what else can I say? He focused a lot on fruit trees specifically, apparently palms and fruits. and we have an extensive archive of all of Elling's papers And I hope to be able to dig through them, you know, over the years. The 108 linear feet of papers.
Oh, it's so extensive that it's not really accessible.
It is not accessible. And we actually have a scholar visiting here from France on a 6-month visa research project to read through his papers and understand and write a description of who this person was and what he was collecting and why he was collecting it. What was the method of his, it's quite an undertaking. But the point of me saying all that is he has a lot of paperwork on what he's importing from Asia, why he's doing it, where he planted it, hand-drawn maps, detailed notes and correspondence. So there's a lot that I don't know about the Arboretum. I think the Hurricane Milton probably knocked out, 30% of the trees, lost a few, and now we're in the process of investing in the Arboretum. You know, it hasn't been cared for very much over the years since his passing. So we're doing all sorts of, new irrigation and mulch and soil amendments and structural pruning and all these things that trees need to be healthy.
So we've talked about Elling's interest in fruit trees and palms. Do you have any idea, was he also interested in the flowering ornamental tropical trees, that tabebuias and erythrinas and jacarandas and all that sort of stuff?
We do have ornamental trees here. They're maybe not a majority of the collection, but the tabebuias, we have several of those and a few different varieties, multiple silk floss trees. I'm thinking of some kind of a Japanese rose that's in bloom right now. It's sort of a smattering. Well, so, we have a number of, Florida native plants with significant spines that must be left over from mega herbivores thousands of years.
Some Hercules club, is that what you're thinking of? Or?
Yeah, I'm thinking of that. Water locust. Salt walnut certainly has a lot of saw on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Lee, let's talk about climate-resilient forests and enhancing those with native plants.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So before coming to the Elling Eye Center, I was at the Conservation Foundation of the Gulf Coast for 16 years. It's now the Big Waters Land Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a not-for-profit land conservancy in Southwest Florida, protecting land. So I'm a conservation biologist, right? So I was there working as the land stewardship manager and helped acquire, save land and restore land. And over the years, I became increasingly interested in working with trees specifically. I think that first happened when I started managing a property in Lee County on Pine Island, which is the southernmost population of longleaf pine. Mm. So it's so far south, this doesn't even show up on the USDA range maps, but there's a population on Pine Island. And for over a decade, I've been collecting seeds from this population. I'm still doing it here at the Elling Eye Center, collecting seeds, propagating them, outplanting them in sites further to the north. So there's thousands of these trees at Duet Preserve. There's some at Terracea. There's some at Oscar Scheer State Park other area preserves.
And what's the thinking there?
Point of this story, so I'll lay the plan. The point of that story is a significant stressor. Our forests are experiencing a lot of stress worldwide, right?
Right.
And in the United States, that's for sure. Florida is no exception. So a significant stressor is just the warming climate. And Florida is this interesting peninsula going north-south, and we have this, latitudinal gradient, and it's getting warmer and warmer to the south and colder to the... So you see trees that are in Manatee County that aren't in Sarasota County. I love that Sarasota County seems to be at this, like, subtropical divide. Things are really changing in Sarasota County. And so the longleaf pine are definitely going to retract in range over the years. And it concerns me that, you know, if you go to buy, so this is what happened. I'm trying to buy longleaf pine for restoring forests, and the seed that's available is from North Florida. And so it's not adapted to South Florida, and it's getting warmer on top of all this. So it's really not going to be adapted in 50 years. You know, and it concerns me that we're managing forests, with an eye to the past and not the future. Well, or that we will if we're not paying attention, right? Important to me to be propagating local ecotypes from Sarasota County or farther south, for restoration projects in our area. And so longleaf pine is one example. If we want to have climate resilient forests, we need to be using restoration material that's prepared for a warmer climate.
So this is a way to pre-adapt areas to rising temperatures by using material that grew further south in warmer areas and doing what the seed dispersal mechanism for longleaf pine doesn't enable it to get from Pine Island to Duet Park. And so,
right.
Yeah.
And so on top of that, you know, our landscape is so fragmented now compared to prehistory, right? So plants that could travel, they just can't travel anymore.
One of the things that's aggravated me over the years is that the concept of native plants, and people will say, well, sycamore is a native plant, a native tree. Well, yeah, it is in North Florida, but that's just an artifact of where the boundary was born for the state of Florida. But there were no sycamores in Sarasota County. And so people are planting trees that are typically found in more temperate climates and rationalizing that, saying this is a good thing. But yeah, you're right. We probably should be looking more to the south, and that we're finding trees that were thought to be restricted to the Keys or the southernmost part of the state seem to be doing pretty well around here.
That's right. Yeah, overall, I think, you know, selecting tree varieties that are resilient to future climate conditions is important. That includes the warming climate, that includes more intense hurricanes, more frequent hurricanes. So wind-resilient trees are going to be increasingly important. And then there's disease resistance. So we're experiencing so many more insect, other pathogenetic issues, you know, affecting forests. We haven't, for instance, in Sarasota County experienced the emerald ash borer, but what will that be like, you know, if it gets down to here? You know, the Myakka River has tons of pop ash forests lining the river, and if emerald ash borer comes down to here, it could really devastate our river system.
We just got a report this week that they're seeing a lot of cabbage palm mortality on the Longino Ranch. That's presumably lethal bronzing. So the cabbage palms are our most wind-resistant native tree, but they are not resistant to lethal bronzing. And they were quite concerned by the number of trees they're seeing out there that are dying. And of course, if the cabbage palms and pop ash were to leave Myakka Park, it would be a completely different place. And there are a number of oak diseases as well that if they got in our live oaks, we would be looking at a completely different ecosystem. So it's a real deal.
So, you know, in my background, my line of work, I've always focused on promoting ecotypes, local ecotypes, seed banking, propagation of local material. I just, you know, the main tool that I think about working with is genetic diversity to be resilient to these unpredictable future conditions.
Talk a little bit about your background. You're a local guy. Talk about your trajectory of how you grew up here and how you ended up in conservation biology. And
I wish I could say that I've planned it out, but I didn't.
Everybody wishes they could say they planned it out.
Yeah. I was born and raised in Venice. Went to school here, graduated from Pine View, went to college, got a bachelor's degree in biology, like a pre-med degree from Tennessee Wesleyan University. I have family in East Tennessee, so I spent all my summers working on our farm and my college years on our farm. Came back to Venice afterward. All my family's really here. Was working at plant nurseries at a school, native plant nurseries, interned at Selby Gardens. Really, horticulture has been a theme throughout my life. And then I ran into the Conservation Foundation. It was actually the grand opening of the Deer Prairie Creek Preserve. And thought, oh, this sounds interesting. Maybe I'll volunteer. So I volunteered for their first Fall Family Festival, which is now Wild About Nature, in late 2009. Seemed like a cool place. I asked for an internship, and they gave me one. And after 3 months working full-time there, they thought, well, he seems okay, I guess. And they ended up hiring me as their first land steward. And then I ended up working there for 16 years because it's a really fabulous organization and mission.
Well, this is a strategy I recommend to new college students to find some place they'd like to work and volunteer, take on tasks until they've concluded you're indispensable, and then tell them you got to go and wait for them to offer you a job. Mm-hmm. That whole volunteer internship paid position strategy, I think, is a great one.
I think, you know, if you work hard, people see that and they want you to be around.
Yeah. If you're doing good work, people will notice.
The Philippi Farmhouse Market takes place every Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. through April. The Farmhouse Market includes fresh produce, prepared foods, artisanal products, and live music. Beyond shopping, visitors can explore the park grounds, including docent-led tours through the historic Edson Keith Mansion at 10 a.m. and the Keith Farmhouse at 11 a.m. each Wednesday. More information is available at sarasotacountyparks.com. Tell us about the BioBlitz at the Ide Center.
The BioBlitz. I am ecstatic about this BioBlitz. So first I'll say what a BioBlitz is. So this is a concept, a citizen science initiative, where the average person, anyone from our community, they can gather together in a place, usually over a short amount of time, maybe 24 hours. It could be as short as a couple of hours. At a place to document all of the living things found in that place. And this is a really fun way to get acquainted with your natural habitats around you, to learn about biodiversity, and to contribute in a meaningful way to science and land management. So May 2nd, we're having a BioBlitz at the Elling Ide Center. You can find this on our website, idecenter.org. Go to visit the preserve, click on events, sign up for the BioBlitz. We're running it from 6:30 in the morning to 8:30 in the evening. You don't have to be there the whole time. You can show up for whatever part of that day you'd like to. You could do the morning, go home, and come back later. We're offering a free lunch and a cheese and wine social at sunset. And this is a team challenge BioBlitz. So teams of up to six will compete, if they so choose, for prizes in four categories. We're awarding prizes for the team that identifies the most significant species of conservation concern, team that identifies the greatest number of species, another prize for team that identifies the greatest number of invertebrate species, because invertebrates are critically understampled, and a prize for the person or team who has the best observation as sort of, and we spell this out on our website, but as defined by like the highest quality photo and the best notes on the species. We're using the iNaturalist app as our platform. So participants will download iNaturalist. They'll take pictures of organisms with their phone. There'll be a leaderboard on the, there's like a iNaturalist page for the Eye Center and a leaderboard of observations. We'll collect all this data, and this will be the first of species surveys going on forevermore at the Eye Center. So over time, then we'll be building a database of observations. It will help us understand this property trends and help us make land management decisions.
Well, this is a fantastic opportunity for our listeners. You know, when Julie introduced you, she mentioned the Eye Center being somewhat obscure. This is not a, you don't have a big neon sign out front saying everybody's welcome all day, stay as long as you want, closed on New Year's or something. This is a place that you pretty much have to be invited to experience. And so this open invitation to wander around the property and identify plants and invertebrates seems like a unique opportunity.
Absolutely. So, you know, in order to support the tranquility and the integrity of our research library and living collection, which are actively studied by visiting scholars, the public can only come to the Eye Preserve by invitation during scheduled tours and events or by volunteering. And those opportunities are on our website, but there's not a lot of opportunity to get onto this property. And what I want to do, you know, as the new director of land management and environmental programs is developed a model of contributory engagement. How can we bring people to the property that are contributing to our research mission and following Elling's legacy of deep engagement?
So we've talked about the Eye property from a motorist point of view, where it's located in relation to some roads, but talk about its situation on the bay.
The Elling Eye Center is located on Little Sarasota Bay. If you wanted to kayak pass it, I think the nearest kayak launch is the Vamo Road launch just to the south. And that's not more than a mile away, maybe under a mile away. It's not far north of Jim Neville Marine Preserve and Midnight Pass. You look across the bay, you're looking at Siesta Key, the south end of Siesta Key. For the most part around it, there's quite a bit of development. So to the south, we do have Jim Neville Marine Preserve, mangrove protected islands down there, but there's not a lot of natural habitat on Little Sarasota Bay that's left, and this is an oasis of habitat on the bay. Something that jumps out to me about this location, looking out on the water, there's a lot of oyster flats and or oyster reefs and clam flats. And Elling and his family, we have historic photographs from the 30s of, you know, big parties and shucking oysters. And he grew up eating this shellfish and was passionate about water quality. So those are some things that come to mind.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Let me introduce our guest today, and we're talking with Lee Amos, Director of Land Management and Environmental Programs at the Elling Eye Center.
So there's some water bodies on the property. Are those saltwater, freshwater, mixed? What's the story with those? And were they created, or is that natural currents?
To our south, our southern boundary is Clower Creek.
Right.
That's a freshwater input into the bay. The bay is obviously an estuary, so it's a little bit fresh water, a little bit salt water.
But it sheds water from Sarasota Square Mall, right?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how the pipes are running.
Yeah,
but,
right.
You know, basically, yes, US 41, mm-hmm. Sarasota Square Mall, all this development, it is probably shedding water through Clower Creek directly mm-hmm. into the bay. It's a very short distance, so it's just kind of sending storm water into the bay.
And it's north of Pelican Cove, right?
Yeah, Pelican Cove is right along our southern boundary.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm remembering correctly, if you were to go sort of west from the main building at the Ide Center, there's like a lagoon or two.
Oh yeah.
Two open water areas.
That's right. So if you were to look at an aerial image, you know, Google Maps or of our property, you would see a peanut-shaped lagoon or lake right against the coast.
Yeah.
This is a fascinating feature because it was created by prehistoric Floridians. So there was a natural scalloping of the coastline here. And the Floridians used shells and other material to connect the north end and the south end of the scalloping together to enclose a lagoon. It's, I think 1.7 acres in size. And, you know, I've talked to an archaeologist or two about this and, you know, the speculation is that like historic Spanish Point, this could have been a ceremonial site. And if large crowds are gathering here, periodically, how do you feed a large crowd? Maybe the answer is to have a lagoon that you can stock with fish ahead of time. And maybe this, there are examples of these kind of lagoons, you know, throughout the world. It's likely that there was an inlet, you know, and they would push fish into here at a high tide and close it and trap them in here. Maybe they would do that repeatedly, build up a fish population, then it would be easy to feed the gathering.
I like it.
Yeah.
So, but my question was, is that, do you know, is that fresh or salt?
It's brackish water.
Brackish, okay.
Yeah, so we have fresh water that's seeping from our scrub uplands. There's a 12-foot elevation difference within... maybe 50 yards. It's pretty steep slope down to this. So we have freshwater seepage. You can see it seeping right into this area. And then the waters of the bay are able to percolate through the berm that the people created.
Okay. So, you know, so far on the show, we've talked about Elling and his passion for the tropical, subtropical fruit trees, palms, and stuff like that, but you should tell us about all the different native habitats on the site and what the challenges you're facing in trying to restore those.
It's such an incredible property, you know, and an opportunity that we have so many different habitats in this area surrounded by urban development. So we have a number of natural communities, including salt marsh, scrubby flatwoods, scrub.
Well, let's slow down. Let's start, let's do them one by one. So there's not a lot, there's salt marsh on the Mayaca River, but I'm not aware of a lot of salt marsh on the bays. So that seems pretty distinctive that you have salt marsh.
Yes, and I don't want to oversell it. It's only probably, I think it's a third of an acre. It's a great little patch of salt marsh. You're right. So Little Sarasota Bay, you know, the slopes of, in order to have a salt marsh, you need a low slope where the tides can go up and out. And you're growing herbaceous plants, that are adapted to this. Most of the time along the bay, we just have a narrow fringe of mangroves.
Right.
And that's all. So to have a salt marsh, we have the sort of a mud flat with fiddler crabs. Yeah, it's not very common.
Well, so does the salt, we had salt marsh at New College. We had a little creek in the uplands that flowed into the bay, and there was a patch of, I think it was Spartina, wasn't it, Julie?
Yes, Spartina.
Yeah. And I think that's gone now, and I don't know what to attribute that to.
I think the mangroves have overtaken the salt marshes, and that's a pattern that's happening all the way up the west coast of Florida. And so mangroves are taking over salt marsh habitat. And that's because there's no longer winter freezes that limit the mangroves.
So another trend worth noting, salt marshes are typically found upslope of mangrove forest.
Mm-hmm.
So as the sea level rises, the mangroves are transitioning upslope into that historic marsh habitat. Now, naturally, the marsh would, you know, transfer upslope of that, but upslope of that are houses. So just lose all the marsh.
Yeah.
And it's a critical habitat.
So I don't know if you've had a chance to look at aerial photographs, but does the marsh area seem to be stable or increasing or decreasing?
Ours is increasing.
Okay.
So I think, this little patch of marsh would have historically been pine flatwoods, I think. And it's now become saltier and marsh.
So let's talk about scrub habitat.
Well, couldn't we go in some sort of topographic slope here? Let's get to the highest stuff last. So what's upslope of the marsh?
Upslope of the marsh, we have a maritime hammock.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, we call it coastal hammock, but maritime hammock's just as good.
Maybe so better.
Talk about how a maritime hammock differs from a hammock in Myakka Park.
Yeah, so a maritime hammock will have a lot of tropical canopy trees that aren't found inland. So they're going to be frost sensitive. They're kind of hiding along the coastline where it's a little bit warmer. This, by the way, is why Elling's planting all these tropical fruit trees right here, right? We're protected from frosts. And the same is true for the native plants. So we have tropical trees coming up from the Keys, the Caribbean, up the Florida coast, and this little narrow band of maritime hammock. And it kind of peters out, this habitat, in Manatee County. There's really a significant site that I can think of in Sarasota County, which is historic Spanish Point of maritime hammock. But it would have been a lot more common historically. Species like Gumbo Limbo, we have a couple of agaves. What am I missing?
Some of the stopper,
white stopper, lantana, the aboriginal prickly apple cactus.
Yeah.
That was found here, and we're going to bring that back.
Selby has some of that.
So, are you looking at prickly apple to reintroduce?
We are.
Okay.
Yeah. So that we found immediately upslope of the, of course, we have a mangrove fringe too. So,
yeah.
And then you go upslope of that, then you'll have mesic hammock. And that'll be somewhat similar to, inland, a lot of live oak and cabbage palm. Ours has a mix with our native strangler fig, Ficus aurea.
And what a great plant. Yeah.
Fantastic. And red cedars. This kind of hammock, mesic hammock, you'll see, throughout the barrier islands. Something that I love to point out about these hammocks, so our migratory birds that are flying down the Florida Peninsula and they're going to fly across the Gulf of Mexico to the Iberian Peninsula, they need food along that route. And these hammocks are filled with berry-producing shrubs and trees. And red cedar and strangler fig are two examples. So you see large flocks of birds. The charismatic ones I think of are like cedar waxwing, going to these trees and feeding on them.
All right. What's next?
So on this property, then we have a little bit of a mosaic around these mesic hammocks of hydric hammock. And they're on the slope right around the lagoon. So we have the freshwater, subterranean seepage coming through to the lagoon from the uplands. And we have some great hydric soils through here that are supporting hydric hammock. So you'll get species like laurel oak and water oak in these areas, as well as kind of littoral zone plants, swamp fern, crinum lily, things like this. So that's mixed in there. If you move upslope of the hammocks here, our property raises in elevation pretty rapidly. And in a short distance, you're now in oak scrub.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's the majority of our property is oak scrub and or scrubby flatwoods.
And this is the prime gopher tortoise habitat?
Prime habitat for gopher tortoise and used to be Florida scrub jay.
When was the last scrub jay seen there?
You know, other people could tell you that answer. It's probably, well, I shouldn't say it, but, you know, there were surveys of this property with documented scrub jays in the 90s. Yeah. But I couldn't tell you the exact date.
That's okay. I mean, the story's the same. It doesn't really matter what year it was. It's a terrible loss. It's a, you know, the habitat that the jays liked is tremendously appealing to put houses on. It's less likely to flood.
Well, our coastal scrub is just totally wiped out, right? So where do you want to build a house? You want it to be high and dry. You don't want to be surrounded by wetlands which is full of mosquitoes. And, yeah. Hey, if there's a high, dry spot that looks at the water, I would really love to have a house there. So that's coastal scrub, and we've lost, you know, almost all of it.
Yeah, when we lived downtown on 3rd Street, there was an alley behind the house, and there was a sand pine. So downtown Sarasota, its high elevation close to the bay was tremendously – it was a natural site to put a city, but it took out all the scrub. And we – I remember one time there was a bar downtown, and they pulled the bar out, and the next spring all this lupin came up.
Sky blue lupine. It's a beautiful plant. So we have that here in our scrub.
Okay. Road from Africa to African America is scheduled for Saturday, May 2nd at the Leonard Reed House, 2529 North Orange Avenue in Sarasota. The program includes a presentation on Ujamaa cooperative economics and a pottery demonstration. More information available at 941-323-6468.
And I might say the other thing that's killing our scrub is lack of fire.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Are you planning to introduce fire in the scrub?
We are planning. So this is a lot of planning that has to be done mm-hmm. and coordination with our neighbors and partners. You know, to burn in an urban area has to be done slowly and thoughtfully. But our habitat desperately needs it. It hasn't seen fire. Parts of it, you know, I'm sure over 100 years. And when you don't have fire, you have this buildup of fuel, which makes the likelihood of a catastrophic wildfire increase year over year over year. It just gets more and more dangerous, and the house has become more endangered by not doing a fire. On top of this, all that fuel just suppresses the plants. So there's now very little habitat for the gopher tortoise left because there's been no fire. And all the scrub jays have left. There's no scrub jay habitat. But with prescribed burning, you can, it's sort of like a light switch. I mean, you can bring that habitat back in a short amount of time and bring the biodiversity back.
Do you know if the county's been able to burn on their Bayonne property?
They never have. That site obviously needs to be burned, but it's surrounded by development, and they're developing even more.
Right.
So if they were to burn in the future, the opportunity here is that if we can get our property burned, then the county would be able to burn toward us on a north wind, push that smoke and fire, so to speak, toward us, and that we'd be their safe zone.
Right. So the concept is there wouldn't be enough fuel in the area you'd already burned.
Right.
And so the fire would basically self-extinguish when it got to an area that had burned recently.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, prescribed burning is kind of like a some type of strategic exercise where you're, you know, burning one place, which is your highest risk burn, and you're putting a lot of resources to keep this safe. And then risk decreases over time because you're burning other units into toward that already burned unit. And by the time we get around to Sarasota County, we should have eliminated all the fuel on our property.
That's great.
So Lee, what else would you like to talk about in your current position as the land manager at Elling Eide Center?
I'm trying to remember.
Well, so here's an easy question. We've talked about the habitats. What are the invasive plant species that you're having to contend with that are thwarting your best efforts to restore this stuff?
Yeah, I think there's three major categories of habitat restoration we need to do here: prescribed fire, invasive removal, and hydrologic restoration. So invasive plant removal is a big category. Some of these plants Elling might have planted himself, and, you know, 50 years ago, we didn't know that they were going to be a problem. Other species would have just come in through bird droppings, but we have a tremendous diversity of invasive plants on the property.
It's sort of like an arboretum of invasive plants.
In a manner of speaking, yes. We have a purposeful arboretum and an accidental arboretum.
That's right.
And we'll be removing those. And that's a combination of techniques. Removing that will free up habitat for all of the native species, and it'll increase a lot of wildlife value. The other big category of work is hydrologic restoration. And, you know, we want to look at how we can improve water quality flowing into Sarasota Bay. Are there opportunities on Clower Creek? That would be the big win. Clower Creek was channelized in the 30s. And so we had a historically sinuous stream flowing out of a bay head. And they turned that into a straight ditch, and then they connected more ditches to it. And there may be opportunities where we can create a series of pools or create more of a meandering channel to increase residence time and decrease that pollution and that runoff that's going into the bay.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's the hydrologic restoration sounds admirable, but I am curious about which plants are vexing you in terms of invasive plant species.
Well, if we want to talk about vexing.
Yes, I want to talk about vexing.
So that, you know, the real visible stuff is not what vexes me.
Oh, well, let's talk about this subtle and conspicuous stuff.
Yeah. So the real visible stuff, like Brazilian pepper, you can cut that down and it's gone and job done. You can do that very quickly. The really vexing material are those herbaceous plants. And something like rose natal grass, for instance, we have rose natal grass growing throughout. We have a meadow all along US 41, which you can see from the road.
It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. It actually is the highest biodiversity on our whole property, is in this wildflower meadow with a canopy of slash pines. And mixed in with all those native wildflowers is rose natal grass. And you have this issue where how do you remove this grass without destroying the good stuff? And it's not a simple answer. Probably for us, there's going to be some cattle grazing involved, and there's going to be herbicide, and there's going to be mowing. So we're using the mechanical treatments of grazing and mowing to try to reduce the total herbicide use.
Yeah.
But even then, with all that, those are all pretty coarse instruments, and it's hard to not impact the native things. And it's going to be a long, long process to get that exotic out. If we didn't do it, then it would just overtake it, and we would lose all the wildflowers.
Yeah, we have a problem with it at New College as well. We also have torpedo grass. I hope you don't have any of that.
I haven't picked up on torpedo grass. I have picked up on a couple of acres of Kogon grass.
Uh-oh.
And that one's a little bit easier in as much as there's so much of it that you can use a broadcast herbicide to get rid of it. We want to minimize herbicide, but Kogon cannot be killed by any other means.
Well, and some people question whether it can be killed with herbicide. I have people at Mayaka Park tell me they treat an area and it's gone, and they come back X years later, and it's back, and it seems like it's a remnant of the original population.
Yeah. It requires diligence.
Well, so we let our listeners know, if they are curious, if they have Kogan grass, it's going to have a sawtooth edge to the grass. It usually has sort of a yellowish tint, to my mind. And if you pick a leaf blade, the so-called midline is not in the center of the blade, but off to one side. It's asymmetrical on either side of the midvein. And then when it's blooming, it sends up the seed head is a sort of cottony poof that extends up above the grasses. And if the plant were smart, it would keep its seed heads really low. But once those seed heads pop up, it's easy to spot it at a distance.
Mm-hmm. You know, invasive plants are identified by the Florida Invasive Species Council. So you can search this and find details on all the species in Florida.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you have a full employment strategy for several decades there.
I do. Yeah. And we're actually hiring positions right now.
Okay. What are you looking for?
We're looking for a full-time land manager, a full-time assistant land manager, and a full-time buildings and ground superintendent.
Well, you should let some of the new college graduates know about that. There might be some interest there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I already posted it on the CEO list.
Okay, I don't know what a CEO list is, but that sounds good.
Yeah, we're investing significantly in our resources here.
Well, that's great. And, you know, it's fantastic to have this center that is attracting people from around the planet to come to either Sarasota or Vaimo and do some research on the extensive collection you have there on these Chinese and Asian documents. And then this work, you know, Elling's diverse interest in plants and the both the diverse native habitats and this arboretum of tropical fruit plants and ornamentals that Elling collected over the years.
Absolutely. And we're looking for friends to join our mission. You know, visit our website, idcenter.org, to learn more. If I might add a little more detail, you know, we are creating a conservation horticulture program here, building a seed bank for species like the longleaf pine, as well as cultivated areas, what we might call seed increase plots. We would take species like Liatris from these development sites, plant them in a sort of a garden bed, and grow them and then harvest the seed. A lot of times in restoration, you don't want to go from harvest site directly to restoration site. It's better to plant it, grow it, and increase your seed 10 or 100 fold or 1,000 fold, and then use that material for restoration. So we're creating this program kind of honoring Elling's interest in horticulture, but with a twist focusing on a modern problem.
That makes sense. Thanks, Lee. That was great.
I had a great time. Thank you.
Yeah. You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show, number 85, featured Lee Amos, Director of Land Management and Environmental Programs at the Elling Ide Center.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers.